You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Welcome back to the Break It Down podcast. Okay, so we finished our, you know, go through of the EP on the last two episodes, if you didn't catch that. And now we're going into the new experiment. This is what I think is going to be really fun, is we're going to go through, we're going to start with Devin and Toby. We're going to incorporate more people, but we're going to go through and archive Emery's story. I don't know if people will find it inspirational or funny or quirky or useful, all those kinds of things. But to me, the idea is to just try to archive our memories and stories and get clarity and perspective now that we have a, you know, 20-year past. It seems more important than ever to me to analyze that and learn from it. And it's also a little fun to reminisce and to capture things before they're gone, because there's a lot of insights. I think it's true about everybody. If you go back and look at your past soberly or in reflection with other people, that can be very, very useful as opposed to simply superficially nostalgic. I think there's some deep reasons to do that. And if it's not too self-absorbed or self-indulgent, then you may be able to take the ride with us if you find Emery's history interesting, or what touring is like, or what touring was like back in those days, or getting a band off the ground. Anyway, that's the endeavor. We're going to cover our songs and what we were thinking when we wrote our songs, and we'll eventually do breakdowns of all the Emery songs that exist in this canon that we're going to do. So this is maybe a several hundred episode endeavor. So we're going to take our time, pace ourselves. The episode we did tonight, we didn't get all the way through, and we had a technological hang-up, and it just dead-ended, but that's okay. The scene and setting that you'll be dropped into is me and Devin and Toby and some other characters in about the year 1998, 99, trying to figure our life out, music, to have an identity, to build friendships, to make a future, make a living, build a life, make families. It was that time of our life that we embarked on the Emery adventure, and in no way did we think it would continue anything outside of a couple of years or a few years, and here it still is. So seems worth thinking a little bit more and talking about. And if you're interested, I hope you enjoy the ride. We possibly will even change the name of the podcast. I don't even know, but we're going to hunker down and do this for a while. But as of now, we're going to break down Emery's history and story and songs on this podcast. That's what it kind of started out being. And I think we've have good success with that. I think people seem to like that. So we will figure this format out as we go and probably become better at storytelling and being organized. But all we can do is jump in. So let's do it.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down.
Let's meet Carter.
Yeah! Well, I've got the opening like this. I've got Once Upon a Time. There were in Rock Hill, South Carolina in 1997. There were 1998. Let's just go 1998. There were two bands. Emery was not one of them. There were two bands, Satchel and Joe 747. And there was, I've got no local music scene whatsoever, no internet or anybody owned a computer. No, we didn't have any gear. We didn't have any money. We didn't have the ability to play music well. We did not possess fans. There was no music or rock or emo or punk culture whatsoever. And the only thing we did have was disapproval.
Yep. From our God.
From both our God and the music we were trying to create. Nobody appreciated it or approved of it really at all. So that's where it begins. In about 1998. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. Now, I want to clarify something here. Y'all always say Satchel, but it really was simply Wayne. I mean, y'all just out of nowhere changed your name to Satchel, but your band was always, I mean, the most
we
time.
We had been Simply Wayne's for the previous several years. That's kind of a backstory thing, which we can do. We got time.
I'm just saying, like, when you say Satchel, I don't even know that band, Harley.
Nobody really cares.
Well, anymore. We wanted to break the Simply Wayne's tag, I think, and it just never... We wanted a cooler name, and it just...
Yeah, we
Simply
wanted
Wayne
a better
sounds
name
like
than
a jam
Simply
band,
Wayne's.
You know, at the bar.
Well, so it was a restaurant in Blue Ridge, South Carolina.
We should have just called ourselves Tabs, because that's what it was before that.
Tabs would have been... Oh, what a cool band name, especially because bands use tabs.
But the origin of that band, if you want to give a quick backstory to that, is we've been doing stuff our own way from the very back at the beginning. We were in Blue Ridge, South Carolina, and we would get together on weekends in my parents' garage and save up money to try to get a bass amp, to try to jam, to try to get Seth to come over, to try to play a Weezer cover. He could play the intro to Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it seemed cool. And we were just trying, you know, we're doing stuff like that for a couple of years. And we had a band, we wrote songs. It's the only band at our high school, Devin and Seth and I. And we, you know, started playing a band just for no reason. I mean, just there was nothing at all. And then we got to college and got exposed to more stuff. And Simply Wayne's was a goofy name. And we were just, we had no abilities or talents or hardly anything, I don't think, at the time.
Right.
And we met in college when we went to Winthrop in Rock Hill, South Carolina, Toby. And Toby was what? Like, you didn't have a band. I mean,
I was like a local hero is the way I would describe myself. But I had a band with Joey, mm-hmm. who wasn't a bass player. And I convinced him he should play the bass. And he started teaching himself, and he bought a little cheap bass and a cheap amp. But yeah,
say have a band when you just wrote songs? You were writing songs, and
because I wanted somebody, to play,
your roommate
I wanted to play
bass, and you called that a band?
Yeah. I mean, we were two people, so I knew if him and I got some songs together, at some point we could find some drummer, and then we'd at least be a three piece. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I mean, once I started, I mean, meeting y'all around the same time. Y'all were all playing music too, and y'all were already in a band. So I was like, well, I got to be in a band too.
And Joey loved music so much. I mean, with emo and indie stuff, it was like, well, it kind of made sense. He just didn't have the talent for it.
Yeah. Like, I started a band with definitely the least talented musician of any band that you would ever start with, for sure. Like, I had some talent, and then I was like, well, you're my friend. So, and I don't want to jump ahead, but wow, we dodged a bullet at him not being Emery's bass player at the moment. At the time, that's a little teaser there. In the future, you'll find out more about Joey Svensson being Emery's bass player. But right now we're talking. Yeah. So it was me and Joey, and we would just, you know, I was trying to write music, and I think he liked it. I still don't totally understand. When I think back to those times of writing music, like, you guys were definitely way more influenced by like stuff that was on the radio at the time. It wasn't hugely popular, but you know, y'all were more familiar with, like, I never listened to Korn before y'all. I never listened to Deftones before you guys. Like, none of that stuff was at all. And I mean, and then obviously, like, you guys, I can remember y'all telling me about Creed. And when Creed came out, it was actually good. Like, people were like, this is actually pretty. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't a joke band at all. It was like, hey, this is kind of awesome. And so, you know, and so you guys opened me up a little bit more to that. But like, that's what's funny is I don't even know how really I got into writing rock music, because all I ever listened to was like not that much rock, I guess. I mean, maybe the most rock I listened to was like Weezer and maybe Stone Temple Pilots or, you know, stuff like that. But I didn't really listen to anything y'all were listening to. And then I guess Joey, after we met and started listening to some indie music. And then I guess because of Joey too, y'all kind of even maybe, you think Joey was an influence to move y'all a little farther to the indie music side too?
Oh yeah, for sure. 100%, so why don't I play a little bit of what Satchel, which was formerly Simply Wayne's sound.
Oh, this is awesome. Man, I'm excited.
What track do you want to hear?
I don't even know.
-9.
The first one. I'll just play the first one.
Yeah, play. All what right. was the first one called?
I have it as track 01 here. I forgot the name of it.
Oh, yeah, I can't remember.
Planets.
Oh, what a good song. This is a great song.
This is what we were doing in 97,
98. Oh. Sounds like Noose.
Yeah.
Morning softly washes in amber your bedclothes. Folded neatly, carefully stacked by the bedclothes. What did I do? I do. If you love
not bad.
Us,
I'm gonna skip it around. Here's a little screamy.
That part was cool, man.
Yeah, that's it. So we were doing, that was the first track on that. So that was pretty good stuff, but that's what we were up to at the time.
It's funny because I remember the lyrics, Ronnie wrote all the lyrics and he was like a poet. So they're all like real poetic and not like rock lyrics
not personal,
at all, really.
Yeah,
it's just funny. I mean, they were good, but they were just different.
Yeah, we hadn't thought of, you know, we didn't understand emo wasn't really in the vocabulary or like personal lyrics and doing that kind of thing. We hadn't even really discovered yet, which is kind of cool. And then Joe 747, I'll show you. What song should I play from there, Toby? This is what Toby was doing.
Gray is a Nasty Color is such a good song, but that's a little bit more poppy. You want something more emo?
I don't care.
I would want to make something that's like funny, bad would be kind of fun, interesting to do.
Maybe
here.
Psycho.
Yeah. Well, here's Psycho then. So this is when Devin and I started playing with Toby and Joey because we thought this music was kind of interesting. It had this emo vibe to it and we were kind of attracted to it.
On the day I was born, why did you waste your time?
And all this is recorded on an 8-track digital recorder kind of thing we used at the time. So the recording wasn't too good, but it's kind of neat.
Where'd you find these at, Matt?
Joey sent me these tracks. He had it.
Nice. I want you to send me all those so I can list them again. Somebody said we should release those in Timberland.
Anyway. You want to hear Nothing Affects Me, some of that?
Yeah, let's hear Joey screaming. Joey scream a little bit.
This is our earliest attempts at doing hardcore stuff and screaming. I'll fast forward in a second.
I always like the song a lot. Potter's, is it called Pottersville? Is that right? Toby?
Do what? Sorry, I was listening to the...
I always like the song, Potter, is it called Potter's Field?
Yeah, the Potter's
Field. Yeah, I like that song.
Yeah, we were a little more on the, it was like some kind of weird mix of pop and indie music or something.
It was indie.
I remember we got on, so we recorded that, and then we got on, we sent it in to Blue Velvet Records, and we got onto their compilation. Y'all remember that? And I was like, oh my gosh, we're making it. This is it, we're on some
y'all
compilation.
Hear the breakdown? Here comes what we thought was a heavy section there.
All right.
That's Joey playing bass, and Joey's going to scream too, I think. That's Joey.
Oh. My Aria Pro 2 guitar, Cray amp.
So you can hear a little potential, maybe, is the best you could say about it.
Wow.
That's cool, man. Everybody's like, man, I kind of like this, actually.
There's some neat energy to it and stuff, of course. It's immature, but I mean, that's what... So the point of this is, we were trying to do this kind of music. We had found it when we had, you know, every day we would just... try to find music and try to wire an amp or try a new thing or do make flyers or try to get people to come to a show. But our shows were stuff like, I mean, this almost sounds good in a way, but it doesn't really let you know that there was nothing. It was no scene. It was in a total void. We could play in a bar until 2 a.m. and play covers and play some of these songs. We weren't playing punk rock shows. There weren't any.
Right.
That's the thing.
There weren't any.
They didn't have them. We just had stumbled into this kind of music, and we're trying to convince our girlfriends and aunts and uncles to come watch us play it, and they hated it. And I can see why, but they hated it.
Right.
Yeah, everybody wondered, why in the world would you do this? What I mean, like, especially like for Devin and I, our voices, we're in choir, we're getting solos in the choir and all this stuff, and people are like, why in the world would you do that? Like, that's not good. Nobody thought any of those songs were anything good, and maybe they were right.
I mean,
but they didn't even see potential. There wasn't even a chance anybody saw, wait a minute, this is what you are right now. Wait for a year or two. Maybe you could be something. You know, nobody saw that.
Because there was no other bands, though. I mean, and we were existing in a weird vacuum at the time. We weren't even, it was really about, this is, you know, some of this music was written in 98 or so. It wasn't until 98, 99 until we started seeing bands really play real shows. Do you remember that first exposure to like seeing punk rock shows for real? Like,
Tremont and stuff.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember the venue Tremont, and that was the place to go, and you just saw these bands. But I can just remember, like, I mean, y'all, that's what I'm saying. Like, I remember y'all, what was Stained is one of the first ones I saw there. And that was because of y'all. And I was like, I'll check this out. But that literally did help me understand a little bit. I was like, whoa, this is something. There's something here. Like, that's the first time I started really thinking about production and what it means. And then, honestly, even though it was a way smaller show, remember seeing Juliana Theory in that side room, and they were already using tracks, and I was like, whoa, this is unbelievable. The way this band sounds is just phenomenal. This is crazy. Like, what they're doing is something that I don't know. And then, of course, Hopes Fall. Seeing Hopes Fall just lose their shit on stage was unbelievable.
So we basically found a venue that was a real venue in college, and we had this kind of explosion of culture right at this exact moment. Some of this music that I showed you, it actually is probably later than our exposure that we're talking about now. But Toby and I bought skateboards at KB Toys when we were 20 and 20 years old in college.
That's true,
and tried to learn to ollie.
Yep,
we went to our first punk rock shows when we were 20 in college, trying to write music, and we found it. Like, we moved from a small town to a kind of a bigger town where it was a college town. Then we could drive to Charlotte, where there were punk rock shows, and it was real. And I say punk rock now, that wasn't the term I would have used at the time. I didn't have a term at the time. Indie, I don't know what.
Right.
And so we saw Hopes Fall, and when we saw Hopes Fall, that was a big one because they were a local band and they were unbelievable. They would get to open some of these shows. Like, we saw Juliana Theory and Zayo.
And they had a following. They had a local following.
Yes.
I mean, and people showed up.
It was crazy. We just had brushed into it. It was like, wait a minute, this band's from here and they're this good and people like them and know them. And I remember seeing them for the first time and they were playing. It was before No Wings to Speak Of even came out. It was when they were just a local band and they had an early album or demo. And they were doing this thing where they would have clean guitar and singing, and it was pretty, but then they would scream their head off, and it was emotional. Right. It was like they were slinging their guitars around and all this stuff. I just remember seeing that show in the small room at Tremont, and I went home and said, well, I have to make something that feels that way. I've got to make something that feels exactly like that. And that's when, that night is when I had made the first attempt at what became Waltz, was that from that experience.
It's crazy.
And so then we turned that into a Joe 747 song. It was just a riff that we thought was, I don't know what we thought about it, but we put it on the Joe 747 recording that we were making at the time, which we were making ourselves on a digital 8-track and had no idea how to record or what we were doing or anything like that. Let me see if I can play.
Well, once again, there was nothing to compare it to. And we were doing, it really was better than everybody else. Like, if you think about anybody else that had a demo or a recording, there's even a few other college bands. I thought what we were doing was like, whoa, we're really doing something here. Like, the way we're recording all these instruments and the vocals and sometimes doing all the things we were doing, I was like, whoa, this, maybe we're
on
something.
But it wasn't even slightly, it wouldn't be popular for another 7 years.
Right.
To anybody. Yeah. So we thought it was cool, but it was going to be another 7 years or decade before anybody
that likes it now would even kind of know what it was. But anyway, the very first iteration of Waltz was this riff, and we just made it a pretty short intro. But this is the first iteration of Waltz. This is our 20 yep. years is what I think is cool about it is yeah. 20 years ago, we came up with this that is Waltz that I guess still pays the fucking bills today. I
right.
don't know. I still play it. The song. People still talk about the song. I get money from it. It's I guess our whole career was made out of that kind of that yeah. moment of seeing hopes fall and getting some inspiration, trying to copy it horribly. But then eventually, you know, we'll get through.
Man, you got your money's worth on that ticket, my friend.
That was a good ticket. Yeah. But here's our first attempt at trying to do something once we became inspired and had seen a scene and everything right. like it. We like to do not a lot of vocals. We yeah. eventually fixed that.
I know, isn't that funny?
We just thought this would be good. People will like this. But this is the finished version and the opening of the Joe 747
right.
demo album. This yep. is the album. First song.
Man.
That's Devin on drums.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
Man, that is so funny too, thinking Devin on the drum.
Yeah, and that was just in our, you know, we had a house in college. We did that, came up with that. So we were seeing bands like Juliana Theory and Zayo and the Deep Elm bands, Hopes Fall. We saw Sunny Day Real Estate, and this all happened in an explosion for us right around 1999, right. which is, I think that's so cool. It's 20 years ago, and we had that inspiration right there. And so because of that, so now we're into our story frame. We said, once upon a time, it was that way. And then every day we would do that stuff until one day we saw these real bands. That's how the story goes. And then because of that pivotal moment, you see, we began to take the Joe 747 thing more seriously. Because at that time, Devin and I had been in this high school band for a long time and we were real serious about it. But we're very interested in what you were up to and Joey, and that whole thing started to become really interesting. But we felt loyal to our band that we'd worked hard at for a long time, playing covers and bar shows and stuff like that. So it right. took a while. But after seeing what the real scene was like, we started to take Joe 747 more seriously and even our band. And we said, wait a minute, there's a scene. This exists. If this exists in Charlotte, then this exists everywhere. And these bands aren't big, but they're doing it and they have fans and it's working and it's worth doing. Let's do it. That would be fun. And I think that's been a big theme for us is we've just always done what we think would be satisfying to do. It wasn't any potential for it. It didn't seem like there was any potential, but there was other bands that did it and it looked like it'd be fun. Never could have imagined it'd be a career or anything. Just, if these bands can get fans and play out of town and play shows with other bands and do this, we got to try. So then, do you remember when we said, well, then we need to start a record label and book a tour was the next thing we yeah. thought after we yeah. saw a show.
Sure shot record.
Start a record label.
Tell me what you remember about that. So our first conclusion after seeing a couple of shows was, well, we need to start a record label and go on tour. That was it.
Yeah.
I don't remember why we both of our bands needed to start a record label. Why?
Because we didn't have one.
We just thought we had to be on a label to get shows and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like we thought if we made a label, so we were on a label, then we could get a show.
Right, right.
So we'll make the label.
Yeah.
Yeah, we thought if we say we're signed to Sure Shot Records, then even if they don't know who it is, because there's a billion record labels out there, that means there's some money behind us. Maybe that we have a fan or two. Maybe there's promotion. So maybe somebody would want to do that. And
how do we book shows in those days, Toby?
BYOFL.com or I can't even remember. I guess it was .com. BYOFL, book your own fucking life. .com mm-hmm. is what it was called.
Yeah.
And it was a bunch of different, somehow somebody collected, different clubs or bars or places to play. And you just would go on the website, and then I don't even think we emailed them. I think it was calling even though it was on a website.
Oh, it was all calling. Yeah. We all we used the website to get phone numbers. And we didn't have
the phone number.
I think we had a laptop then. I had a computer by that point, but it was just like there was nothing there, but you get on Napster. Yeah. And you could find phone numbers on it. And BYOFL had phone numbers, and you would call a promoter or somebody, a bar in, Jacksonville and just say, please let us play.
I was the big pusher for that because I was just like, if we go on tour, it'll make everybody think this is real and it'll mean something to everybody. Because, I just thought this will legitimize us. Like, this will make us a touring band in a sense. And I can remember just calling all these different places in the South. Florida, Georgia, even Alabama, North Carolina, all those places, and just trying to book some shows. And what was really funny is this is how bad, if y'all remember where we were in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Do y'all remember where our very first show was?
No.
It was in Miami. We drove all the way
Little Haiti.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Little Haiti was the very first show.
At Churchill's.
Yeah, at Churchill's, which we still play at, which is hilarious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when we go back to Churchill's,
we got a gig at a real place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we didn't know it, but yeah. Nobody was there except for Joey's brother and his wife. And
literally, it was our first gig out of town. We booked it. It was in Miami. Little Haiti. It's a place called Churchill's. A real venue that we still play today. It was really cool. But why would anybody there come see us?
Right.
Our two bands.
Yeah, I thought if you're booked, well then, I didn't even, what's funny? Is even thinking back to then, I didn't even realize like local bands or anything like that. I did, once we were on that tour, but I didn't even think about that, like they had a draw or anything, even though we had played with some local bands. I just figured, if you get booked, then there'll at least be, 30 to 50 people there. That's just what I thought. We booked that our very first show. I can remember, we were in Little Haiti and it seemed kind of scary. We're just these idiot kids from South Carolina and
in a caravan of cars with two bands and three cars.
I tried to negotiate like getting paid, and we were supposed to get every show like maybe 30 or 40 bucks or something like that. But obviously nobody came, and the lady at the bar was like, "Hey, I hold on," and she gave us like three cans of like beans or something like that. I don't know if y'all remember
some
that.
We had shepherd's pie.
And there was
but
a guy.
But it was literally just Joey's
outside.
Brother was the and his wife were the only people that watched us play music that night.
Yeah, and they had to
they
sit through both of our
Pompano
full bands
Beach or something.
I remember one of the shows that we thought was like ended up being awesome was in Orlando, where we show up at the place we're supposed to play. Basically, the place's marquee, the sign is like, I think it's like looked like it had fallen down or burnt down. The place didn't even look like it was open.
Yeah.
And so we get there and the bartender's there. Some eventually, and we say, "Hey, yeah, we're supposed to play here tonight." He's like, "Yeah, okay, set up or whatever." So we set up. Literally, nobody shows up at the time the show's supposed to start, or even whenever the bar's open or whatever. So it's just the bartender, and we're like, "Screw this, we're out." So we pack up our gear. Toby manages to talk the guy into giving us like $30 for gas or something. And these two girls pull in the parking lot as we're loading our trailer and our gear. And they say, "Hey, what are you guys doing at the show? We were going to come or whatever." And then they tell us about an open mic at a place down the street. So we drive about a mile or two down the street and it's a biker bar. And there's all these
open mic. Yeah.
Yeah. Open mic and all these biker people. And we go in and it's like a lot of people there. And we're like, "Oh, this is awesome." So all these people are playing like acoustic, like Eric Clapton.
Right.
And we pull in these huge, like
rolling
half stacks and all this stuff and play full on like rock music. And they, for some reason, most of the people there loved it. They thought it was awesome. Sold CDs that night. The only bad part is I remember the one girls we walked outside, she goes, "Why y'all got to play that heavy shit?"
Yeah, she's mad.
Right, we walked out the door.
Mad. Yeah, they just, that we would be.
But that was one of the better
rock.
Shows of the tour. It was at
but
a
it was
biker
an open
bar.
Mic, and we didn't get paid, yeah. And we got to play like three
right,
songs. That
right.
was that.
But we sold like five CDs or something.
Oh, yeah. I don't. This is funny. This must have really left an impression on me, this tour, because I'm remembering, like, my brain doesn't work this well usually. But, like, so if y'all remember, we also played over in Tampa, and we played this weird little coffee shop, and Seth's drum was right against the front window, and he was hitting when he would, you know, he was tapping it. And, but three, you know, buildings down or whatever was a real punk show that was happening. You remember that punk band? Mm-hmm. I wish I could, God, I could remember their name. But we met them. They're a real band. They were nice. I was like, whoa, this is really crazy. And then we also, in, I believe it was Tallahassee, played a, I want to call it like, at the time what it was called was like Alternative Library or something.
Yeah,
but it was like LGBTQ.
Mm-hmm. Like artistic kind of play.
Yeah. It was everybody there was like LGBTQ.
Like a bookstore
kind
of thing.
And, yeah. But it was a good show. Like there was like several people there. And that's where we saw, what was the name of that awesome
that math
band?
Rock that band.
Ivy Labs.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is really crazy. And we got to play that show. So here's the other thing. So we're coming back up out of Florida. Most of our shows are in Florida. And we go to Athens and we play at a little bookstore there, if y'all remember. Mm-hmm. We played at a little bookstore. Nobody was there. The guy that booked the show was kind of cool, but nobody was there. It was supposed to be a little bit. But I was like, man, we're in Athens. This is really cool. I think that's the only time I've ever been to Athens, by the way. Now, that show, nobody shows up. And by that point, everybody but me kind of wants to call it and just go home.
That's right.
But we have another show in Alabama, and I'm tried to convince everybody, but nobody wanted to. And we just, that's where the tour ended. We're like, y'all chose right. It was just costing us money and there wasn't anything. But I was like, no, please, there's one more show. We booked it. What if that one's the one that's amazing? You know what I mean? Like what
we've
if
we've had all strikeouts so far? Yeah,
right.
Like we
basically
did like
all
eight
strikeouts.
Or nine shows that we hustled our way into booking, and every one of them was an abject failure, like in every way. Like there wasn't anything. I mean, it was completely nothing, and we were still doing it. But that's the thing that was, you know, and because of that, it became apparent that the band that Devin and I were in. And the people in it were not committed in the same way or energized by the same thing.
Right.
So that was the big got out there and did that tour, if you can call it a tour. We just drove places with instruments is really more what it was.
Right.
But it was exhilarating in some sense because you figured something out or you knew something or you were. I mean, it's kind of, just kind of weird to think about. It's just the same feeling today. You got to get there and you got to find it. Yeah. And is it going to be okay? And you're going to be embarrassed and it's not good, but maybe it's good and maybe something good could happen tomorrow. And you're just, that's the kind of, I remember starting to feel that feeling that I still have, you know, now it's like the daily feeling I have is the same as that tour. I feel the same today as I did then, like, oh, this is stupid, but we got to try. We have to.
Yeah. I mean, it put it inside of me, and I was wrong. The very first show was in Charleston, South Carolina, and that's important because if you remember, we played at some little, I think even your sister was there, Matt. Maybe I think your family came and was staying at a beach house, but there was people at that little.
Oh, yeah. We played at VFW.
Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And there was
actually
people there, so I was like, oh, first show, man, there's like, you know, 15, 20 people. This tour is going to do it. And then we drove all the way to Miami, in Little Haiti, and no one was there. And I was like, oh, this is what it is. But it did put inside me, like, I would have gone for the rest of the summer. I didn't care how much money it cost or anything. Like, just being on the road was like, oh, my gosh, it just felt real. I mean, that's what I thought. Right. I just like, oh,
it
man.
It was a real experience.
I'm on the road with my band, regardless of what the income is or outgoing money. Like, it felt like, oh, this is what I got to do.
Well, let's go a sidebar here, because at this point, we make a decision to move. I mean, we have that experience, and most of the people involved said, this is stupid.
Yeah, that was dumb.
Yeah.
And some of us said, this is not dumb. So what was it that we didn't go do? I mean, if you think about it this way, I mean, I think about it like this. We were finishing college by this point, and you're supposed to start a career, and everybody's telling you what you got to do, what you need to do, and there's girlfriends and jobs and, you know, for instance, my dad owned a business that I could have had or taken over. And yet this is, I say no to that stuff. Let's try this stuff. That, you know, it was powerful enough to continue that. And then, you know where the story's going here, but it, like, what were the things to pursue that was at the expense of what type of things for us? Like, what would have been the normal path for 21-year-olds that just discovered punk rock and skateboards?
Well, it's crazy too. I mean, I'm trying to think time-wise. Was that tour in the summer of 2000 or was it 99? It was the summer of 2000.
Well, I don't know if that was 99 or 2000. I'm not sure.
I'm just trying to frame it in my mind again, but 99. So when we come back, we still have, a year of school left, right. More, mm-hmm. Year and a half, 2 years almost. And then we're starting to decide on, I'm like finalizing, my music degree and all this stuff. And some people are doing education and our other band member, Seth, mm-hmm. I don't even remember what he was doing. Is, psychology or something. And then we had these other guys who had normal job. It was just like, I remember thinking this is what I would love to do, but I don't know if it's realistic. I just remember, you know what I mean? Right. Like, I remember thinking, mm-hmm. like, but what are we really going to do?
Right.
It's always in your mind. I think that's with everybody. It's like, yeah, you have these things that you would do or you'd like to do or it'd be awesome if you could do.
But there's no path.
But yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to blaze your own trail, I guess, but that's hard and most often not successful.
Yeah, so, I think we had seen Branson play at the Fat City Cafe in Charlotte for 30 people. Yeah. And I thought it was the best show I'd ever seen. And right. I thought, well, if you can have the best show you've ever seen for 30 people at a cafe, I bet we can eventually do that.
Right.
Now, we couldn't get 30 people to come see us. Right. I understand that. But I thought eventually, I bet we could get 30 people to watch us play.
Right.
And then I'd be 100% happy because that was so, I mean, what I saw with a show with 30 or 40 people where the band was leaving it all on the table and going for it was so amazing that I thought that seems achievable. 30 people.
Yeah.
That'd be good. If we ever get to where they are now, I'm a happy man.
Well, that's true because all that stuff, like, especially, Matt and I in high school and stuff like that, listening to the bands we did on the radio and everything, not really having any idea what independent music was. And all of a sudden in college, we start going to tons and tons of shows. I don't even remember. It was just all the time. Anytime we heard of a good show coming. And that, I think that really made us realize that all these bands weren't very big.
Not that big, right?
It's like
that
was they're the normal part. People like, who were just
you can do it.
Yeah, yeah. These are normal dudes who are just going from city to city like we did or tried to do. Right. But there's a few more people there. Maybe they're getting paid $100. Maybe they're selling some merch, you know. So yeah, that put in my mind and in your guys' mind even more so as well, is like, well, I guess you can just try it without dying. You know what I mean? Without like starving or not having anything. So I mean that was a big part of it.
Yeah, it's a time in life when other people are getting married and doing other things. And to me, it just seemed like, well, I could do that later, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing here for me, too, is this was a seriously crux change point from, listen, we're trying to finish up college. And the reason you go to college is to get the career to do the thing that you go to college for. And then I'm also trying to figure out, like, I become friends with you guys and I'm starting to fit into your crew, but Joey's my best friend and we have our band and we have our thing and y'all have y'all's thing. And so where do we fit? Because if you remember, I mean, y'all had years on my friendship with y'all, but still our friendships were really new and raw in this.
Yeah. I'll go backstory there. I've been hanging out with Devin and this is true. My first memory of Devin is him doing an impression of a baby crying at baseball practice when he was 7 and I was 6.
And I thought
it was funny as hell that Devin could actually sound like a baby crying. He was cutting up, like entertaining people with an impression, which he could still do it, Devin.
I do it for my kids now. They love it. That's so funny, though, because that was
when I was 6 years old, you know?
That's insane. But yeah, you're right, Toby. I mean, I felt like us and you, we were becoming like best friends and all that stuff. But you're right. It was still really, really new. I mean, our friendship was only a couple years old.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm even thinking back now, it's funny because like back then, still like the idea of Joey having depression or working through some mental stuff didn't even like make sense. That didn't even almost exist. I mean, literally, back then, like in the 90s, depression was this weird commercial I would see where it was a lady that looked kind of sad, and they said, can you not get out of bed? And like, you know, I was like, what is this? What in the world is going on? And I can remember now, too, like, I'm certain even on that tour, Joey probably was struggling with certain things. And it just the whole idea of going on tour, figuring out who we were, and then trying to make the decision, wait a minute, don't do what you went to college for. Or, you know, well, I mean, y'all were music majors, but still, you were supposed to, you know, not do music. Music was just a thing. This like right. It might as well been French lit. You know what I mean? It wasn't what you were going to do for a living.
And this is still very far off from moving to Seattle, and we still don't have Emory at this point. We're just exploring music and what any of this stuff is, kind of a thing, and doing it ourselves. So, you know, that summer leading up to that, we had also done something else really important, which was try to raise money and do the booking and all the legwork that would have gone into doing that tour, which, if you'll remember, it was really only us that did that work. So Toby and I would go do sound. I had a sound system. I'd go take it down and do it for the bar bands, and we'd save $75, and we'd take this trailer, and, you know, we'd make the flyers, and we had to make a real record label because we said we were on a record label, so we made logos and went to Kinko's and paid flyers whenever we play at a frat party or anything else, and
tried I totally to just forgot treat that it seriously. We sent letters to people for money. I totally forgot about that. That's hilarious.
We raised money.
A real letter in an envelope said, "Dear so-and-so, thank you
for we aim to do this and that and achieve this, and we're here to really try." You know, it's just
that's cool.
Crazy. And then, but, you know, the main point of it being that the other people that we had been involved with there, no offense to them, I mean, were making good decisions, which is, this is not a good idea, and this is not my future, you know, is what they were understanding at the time.
Right. But
that wasn't the way I was feeling about it. I was pretty damn excited.
Oh, man.
It's funny, too, now when I think back on it, like, even our families, what did they think? Because we at least had some clue of what it was like to go on a tour or play a show locally or something like that. Like, they had seen, like, okay, for example, y'all's parents had seen your band, Simply Wayne's, play some local shows, but there never could have been a chance where they thought, oh, this is something. They're on to something, right? Like, they didn't know. There's no way. And so, I mean, not only were we trying to figure out what music should we play, what do we want to sound like, what do we want to be like, where do we want to take this, but also, I mean, like you said, nobody even could understand. There was no bridge to build that because we were back in the 90s, early 2000s eventually, just trying to mail things out and say we were something, and that a label mattered. Like, I mean, imagine me talking to my family saying, yeah, we started a label. My dad couldn't even understand
The word tour meant or label, nothing.
What does that mean?
Well, it wasn't just that. It was that there was a scene. Like, if you went back to that time, there were real bands, and they were touring. It was the Get Up Kids were doing stuff, and Further Seems Forever was a band, probably, or whatever.
But only we would have known that. Nobody else, almost at our college, knew that.
Yeah, we just were disconnected from it, so we were just doing some other weird thing in this limbo bar. All we knew was you call bars and try to play at the bars until 2 in the morning because you play music. That's just what the culture we came from.
Yeah.
And we still hadn't really understood music scene. Like, we still weren't anywhere near a music scene of any kind, but we knew it existed. They just didn't know how. You meet those people and talk to them and play with them, and they like you, and you like, you know, you could see that stuff existed, but we didn't know how to access it at all. So we'd booked that, and we'd done that, and because of that, we, you know, again, we'd see that the other people were not. And so here in the story we go to, until finally we formed Emory. We started playing, Devin and I started playing more with Joe 747 with Toby and Joey, and thinking that was more and more satisfying.
Yeah.
And eventually our band fell apart. It just wasn't gonna go anywhere, and that became more and more apparent. And so we started saying, well, should we play with Toby and Joey, or how's this gonna work, or whatever? And we made the decision, you know, and you can tell as much of the story as part of the story as you like.
Well,
but we
don't jump ahead too soon. That's interesting. It's interesting you said that too. I don't want to. I was in a band with Joey, so the idea of getting either one of y'all, who we thought was an established band, like, we thought Simply Wayne Satchel, like, I mean, if y'all remember on the tour we booked, we let y'all headline because y'all were y'all been y'all know what y'all are doing. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? Like Joe 747 was the opening act. We're just our first tour. Y'all know y'all played bunches of shows, all that stuff. But it's interesting. Like the idea was we had gone through a drummer or two, and then like Phil and Will played drums with us, but it wasn't working out. Nobody was committing. So Devin playing drums with us, I was like, oh, this is so awesome. Cause you know, maybe Devin would sing some too, or also just contribute way more than Joey even actually could. You know what I mean? Not maybe he'd want to, but like you actually played music, you're a music major and all that stuff. And then Matt, I don't remember when you came over and started playing with us. It was probably towards the end, right? I guess. Cause you didn't play with us as much as Devin, did you?
No, Devin was playing more. I was pretty committed to Satchel and Simply Wayne's. I just thought that was my thing and I needed to make sure I was doing that, you know. But I was interested in recording and I was like, okay.
Yeah, you helped us really a ton recording. That was the thing, yeah. And you played on a record a lot. Yeah,
and I would play and record you guys and just, I was like, man, this is fun. This music has a different thing to it. So I'll do as much as I can here. You know, hey, what, you know, this is pretty cool. So I'll try to be involved here. If our band gets big and your band gets big, we'll both be big together. It'll be great.
I wanted to talk to y'all about that. Did y'all feel any like pressure? Like you just said, did y'all feel like I felt like I was coming in to the into y'all's thing. Did y'all feel that like y'all were coming over to our thing? Was there any like Simply Wayne's guys not liking that like Devin played with drums with us, or did they care at all? Was there anything like that? Like y'all were moving from Simply Wayne's a little bit into the more indie scene instead of radio rock stuff?
I don't remember the other guys caring that much. You know, I think it was a situation where we were probably more loyal and careful and take it more seriously than was necessary when I look back on it. You know, I don't think anybody cared. I just felt like, well, I've got to take care of my guys. I got to make sure everybody's happy. I was probably in those mindsets of trying to facilitate everything to work well is what I remember. Like if I can get, I mean, from the very beginning, all it was me. I got a guitar and then I wanted somebody to play drums. So I bought a drum set. I saved up money and bought a drum set so Seth could come over and play it. And then I bought a bass amp and for Ronnie said, will you come play bass if I get a bass amp? And you know, but that's just kind of my thing. I just want
to
do what I want to do. So I'll make it easy for everybody else and try to keep everybody together and try to make it happen. And then I'll get to do what I want to do. That's what I wanted to do. So I would, you know, and so, Toby's, I remember just thinking you had a spark of like creativity. It was on another level, you know, because Devin's right. We weren't really a functional band in that. We weren't writing whole songs with the front man expressing himself and really cutting it open and getting there. Right. And you were doing that. And so we just had songs and lyrics and chords and notes and a band and a trailer and lights or whatever. We just had whatever we had. But you were doing a thing that was... like it was colorful and real and done poorly perhaps, but you could hear, you know, you could hear the potential and you could hear the transcendent qualities of it. And it was like very attractive. Yeah. And so it's just like once exposed to it, that's the direction I was headed, but with obligation to other people still.
It's funny you say that too, because like when I stepped in originally, another one of our friends named Gabe, going back really far, he was like the singer who kind of jammed with you guys. And then I kind of, for some reason or another, I just kind of started hanging out and all this stuff. And I could sing, so I would kind of sing with Gabe. We'd both sing. And eventually Gabe, for whatever reason, didn't come around, wasn't doing it. And so I just kind of did it. I became the singer. And I was just a good singer, but that was it. I had no, like, creative, like, I didn't want to write music. I didn't really care about that. I had no drive at that point. I didn't know how to write or play or anything. All I could do was sing really well. And so Matt and them were kind of that. So I was like, oh yeah, I'll sing this cover song. I can do that song. That's no problem. But you were kind of the opposite. I mean, you had a great voice, obviously, but you kind of were more like, man, I just have these ideas. I got to get them out. And you just got them out. Yeah. But me, I kind of came in from the other direction. I came in on, well, I can sing really well. I don't really care about writing music, but I really like music. But then all of a sudden, like, I just got this itch to write. So I started playing guitar, piano, kind of figuring that stuff out. And that was when I was like, oh, you can write it.
When you joined, did you even play the guitar much at all?
No, I didn't play anything. Nothing.
When you joined Simply Wayne's, you didn't even play an instrument at all?
I just sang chorus.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I became friends with these guys, I was like, hung out, and they were like, well, Devin can sing really good, so just sing Silverchair. We'll sing Weezer, you know, whatever.
Right.
So I just started helping Gabe out with that, and then eventually I just kind of was the singer. And that was just my thing. I could sing really well, but I had no notion of how to play anything or...
That is crazy. I didn't know that at all.
How to write. I didn't care about writing music or anything like that. But you kind of came in from the other direction. I mean, again, you were a great singer, but you kind of had these creative ideas. It took me some years to kind of get to the point where I was like, oh, I really want to... Maybe I do want to write music. I didn't even think that was like a thing.
It's like we didn't understand the idea of like self-expression even.
Yeah.
Right.
It wasn't even really, I just thought you play the guitar the way you just play the guitar and you sing the notes. You write a song, I guess, but the notion of like expressing yourself through your instrument and a song you would write to say something that you felt coming out was not, just wasn't, I didn't have that concept yet. I didn't even possess the concept. And so I was like, oh, Devin has a good voice. If he uses that good voice to sing these notes, that'll work. But it's a little short-sighted, of course.
I mean,
that's what I thought.
That's what's cool about it is because like our technicality on our side mixed with Toby's emotion, you know, it kind of just, that's what creates Emory. And that's what's really funny is like we had those before in two separate entities. You know what I mean? Like those existed before, obviously got better over time, but eventually combined and became what it is now, but they started on the different ends of the spectrum. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I just thought that's kind of cool.
I do think it's kind of crazy too that like us three have always been the core of Emory probably. And we were all there from the beginning and we're still here and we've probably contributed the most musically and career wise, like our goals and all that stuff. It's interesting that all of us not only had the desire for the music, but also to go that extra mile. Like all three of us said, okay, we graduated. Okay, let's just move to Seattle. All three of us said, you know, like usually
it's harder yet.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. We talked longer than I thought on this. So maybe this is a good teaser for the next episode. But I love that idea that like, us three somehow were committed to something. I don't even know if we knew what it was back then.
It's really hard to. I mean, I remember thinking of that point in my life as maybe a 19 or 20 year old. There was a girl that was a exchange student in. That's how Joey met his wife. Was an exchange student at our school, and there was another one that Devin dated that we're friends with. And I couldn't believe it. They were just from other places and knew other things. I knew the world was big and out there. And I remember having a conversation. She said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And it was the kind of question like you asked me, like, "Well, man, what are you? What the hell are you doing?" And I'm like,
"Yeah."
Are you serious? Like, I'm actually supposed to know? Like, I don't.
Right.
And I just remember thinking, well, something will happen and there'll be an opportunity. And whenever the opportunity comes along, I'll do it. That's what I'll do. Like, whenever something crazy, whenever there's something to do, I'll say yes. I knew that I would say yes if something's going to happen and I'll do it. That's the way I felt. I didn't know what it could be. It wasn't even on my mind. I didn't have a plan or something. It's just like, well, I'll do something when, you know, it won't be normal and it won't be boring. And when it's time to do it, I'll say yes. That's just the way I kind of always had felt, you know, and I don't, I mean, I didn't mean much at the time. I didn't really know what that was, but I just had that sense like, well, other people are too careful. I'll just do something when I don't know what yet, though. That's the way I felt.
Yep. I was the opposite. I mean, like in a sense of like, it was more, obviously a more conservative approach is like, well, should probably finish school, get a job, you know, I'll probably get married pretty young. I mean, that's just the normal things that I thought, you know.
Well, I was super far off from like being able to get laid or get married or anything, so it didn't matter.
Right.
You know, yeah.
That wasn't really on the radar.
Well, and even with relationship stuff, like you guys had girlfriends the same time I did. And then a big push for me, I don't have to go through all this, but a big push for me was when the girl I was dating for a long time and on and off with got engaged to her other boyfriend. I was like, that's it. What do you guys want to do? I'll do anything. Whatever.
Nothing to lose, right?
You know what I mean? It was like, yeah, all right, well, here we go. Let's do something.
Man, if that wouldn't have happened, you probably wouldn't have gone with us, right?
I mean, no.
Like, you kind of need to get your heart broken to start Emory.
Yeah.
Isn't that
so
crazy?
We're not going to get to the part of us moving or anything like that. We're just at the point of playing in a local band and trying to make a better local band is really as far as we've gotten. But we did decide to make our local band before we started. I don't even remember the timeline exactly, but we decided to start Emory itself before we moved or had the idea to move. No, I guess that's not quite true.
Well, so you remember there was a time in between that something was Satchel. I don't remember exactly how it happened or what happened, but remember me, you, Paul Vicnair, and Ronnie, I guess, started this other band. Do you guys remember the name of it?
I do. I looked it up today.
Oh. Kid, Iron Kid?
Iron Kid, yeah.
Yeah.
We played one show at that little coffee house place.
At a coffee house. Open mic coffee near house the we college. Got a gig at.
And I remember
downtown Joe
747 played that show too, I think.
And I remember, I think that was one night, I think that was when, I feel like Toby and Joey maybe thought something a little different about it. Like, because it was more emo. Because we played The Secret. That was we wrote The Secret. And I remember Joey thought so awesome and all this stuff. And I think that kind of started maybe some wheels turning in Joey's mind more like, oh, maybe we can go this direction or something. You know, I don't know specifically, but I remember that was a change in everything. You know what I mean?
So let me try to say it in those terms was our band was falling apart. We knew we didn't want to do music. Toby and Joey had this other band, but we had not yet combined. So me and Devin started writing songs inspired by what Toby and them were doing that were actually rooted in emotional stuff and expression. So Devin had finally come into his own, which was quite nice. And he, and then I'm sure I helped, but Devin wrote The Secret, like the song that everybody likes now. That's the last track on The Week's End. And this is 99, right around 2000, 20 years ago. Devin wrote The Secret. He just wrote the song and we started learning it and played it. And we went and played it at a coffee house. Me and Devin.
Yeah.
And who played with us?
Paul Vicnair and
we
Ronnie,
had a roommate. And our roommates that lived at our house came and we went and played and did that. And then that's the secret. We evolved it a little bit and that eventually wound up on the Columbus EP, which was Emory's first demo. So I am skipping ahead chronologically, but I'm going to play that. So amidst this time, Devin's, we came up with something pretty cool. I'm not going to play it. You know why? Because it's 8.5 minutes long. So we won't listen to the whole thing, but I'll skip around.
As soon as Devin taught himself the guitar and how to write music, he wrote an 8-minute song. Yeah. All of our songs are long back then.
I mean, it's slow developing here, too. I mean, so... That's a fade out's in the track, by the way. That
love that snare sound.
Oh yeah. It's coming back. All right. Not sure what's going on, but my audio is gone. What the hell? Hey, check, check, check. Toby and Devin, you guys hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
I've lost my audio.
Yeah, I don't know why you're not on there, but you're even on the live feed. So, but while Matt's figuring this out, we do thank you guys all for joining us. It's been kind of crazy. Like, we got 130 people on Facebook. We got 40 or 50 over here on Twitch. This is really fun. We're going to be chronicling and going through all of Emory's story and playing old music like this and playing some live music and doing some different stuff. But it's going to be a fun little journey. Hopefully you'll join us for the next, how many years is this going to take?
This will last till we're about 50.
Yeah. It'll take as long as it took to get to 2019, right? So we got, 20 years or so.
Y'all can hear me?
Yeah,
now.
Totally.
Yeah, so maybe y'all can hear me, but I can't hear anything. My audio's gone, so I want y'all to wrap the show.
No, the music's already off. And,
oh, it is off now?
Yeah, but it was right on the big part, and everybody's like, no!
All right, we're wrapping here. Thank you guys so much for joining us. This has been awesome. We're going to do more and more stories. There's a ton coming. Join Emery Land. We appreciate it. Matt will figure out his audio. This has been a blast. Whatever Matt's saying, I'm ending it for myself. Thank you guys so much. There's more to the story. The story doesn't have to end here, so we don't have to do what Matt says, since he can't hear us and is annoying. So thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
Ever heard of Stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of Stoicism with a lowercase s and not Stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is Stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.